Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guest today is Adam Makos, author of Spearhead, An American Tank Gunner, His Enemy, and A Collision of Lives in World War II. Adam Makos is the author of New York Times bestseller A Higher Call and the critically acclaimed Devotion. Inspired by his grandfather's service, Makos chronicles the stories of American veterans in his trademark fusion of intense human drama and fast-paced military action, securing his place in the top ranks of military writers, according to the Los Angeles Times. In the course of his research, Makos has flown a World War II bomber, accompanied a Special Forces raid in Iraq, and journeyed into North Korea in search of an MIA American airman. Adam, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
You've obviously worked on many great military stories. What drew you to this one?
This one I was actually led to by a tip from a friend. He had said there's a hero living in obscurity in Allentown, Pennsylvania. His neighbors don't know what he did in the war. I don't think his family knows what he did. But he had once been this famous tank gunner back in 1945. And when I knocked on the door, I met this hero who I call a gentle giant, because he's a big, tall guy, but he's got that warm, kind of jolly way about him. And it was hard to imagine him as a tank gunner, but sure enough, I would find he was one of our best.
So you just went up one day and just knocked on his door and asked if you could sit down and talk?
It literally started that way. And he pulled up a chair for me at his kitchen table, and he laid out this map of where his division had gone. Now, I had never heard of the Spearhead Division before. I knew of the 101st Airborne. I knew of the 82nd. I knew of Patton's 3rd Army. Mm-hmm. But the 3rd Armored Division was a mystery to me. I mean, the best I could figure out was Elvis had served with them in the post-war years. And it turned out that the Spearhead Division was a silent division because they were often behind enemy lines. They were specialists at breaking through the enemy lines and then running amok, sowing chaos. And a lot of times the war reporters were not sending back dispatches. So this unit lost the most tanks of any American division in World War II. They lost more men than the 82nd or the 101st. And yet today, practically no one knows of their wartime fame.
Wow. Yeah, it strikes me when you mention that they were called the Silent Division, because I feel like the book opens with a very eerie scene where you've got, so a few months after D-Day, you've got 5 tanks from the division's Easy Company sitting in a field in Belgium, and our hero, Corporal Clarence Smoyer, is on watch in the middle of the night, and he hears vehicles approaching. Can you take it from there?
Yes, this was, again, what the Spearhead Division was known for. They had broken out from France, and they found out there was a German army hightailing it across northern France. So they turned on a dime, drove north, long drive behind the lines, and set up this armored ambush. And so the tanks are roadblocking every road they can find across Mons. And in Clarence's sector, there's 5 tanks, and they're coiled in a field, and they're just waiting for any sounds to come down the road in front of them. And Clarence took the watch that night. So he's in the turret. He's got the hatch cracked open. And he hears an enemy tank pull up. And not only does it pull up, it turns when it drives by him, and it parks right in the coil with him and his buddies. So suddenly he's got a German panzer tank of some sort. He doesn't know at first, parked right next to it. And it's idling. And they decide it's going to be like a showdown. Who's going to fire first? The Germans at the time didn't know they were in the middle of the American coil, but sooner or later they're going to find out. And so it falls to Clarence to make this shot in the dark, basically. That night, that German tank was parked next to him. It was the longest night of his life. He had to wait until daylight, and then it was a matter of a almost blind shot. I almost don't want to ruin it, but let's just say he knocked out that tank, and it was a Panzer IV, his first tank kill of the war.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a remarkable opening for the story, and leads into a lot of action going forward. And then, meanwhile, to the south, we meet Clarence's German counterpart, the gunner Gustav Schaefer. Can you tell us about him?
Well, the amazing thing about this story is it's a war story told from both sides. And when I first met Clarence, he was telling me about some of his tank duels. He told me about how he had fought the Panther tank in Cologne, which we'll get to. But he had also said, I found the German I fought against in Cologne, and I think I'm going to meet him. And so all of a sudden, a whole new chapter opened up. This book went from being good to being one in a million, to being irreplaceable. And I was able to tell the story of Gustav Schaefer. I interviewed him. I spent time with him. And Gustav was just a teenage German radio man bow gunner on a Panther tank at first, and later he segued over to the Panzer IV. It's actually a step back for him. But he was just a simple kid from northern Germany, a farm kid. He turned 18 on the field of battle in September 1944. And it was interesting to me because, you know, we always have this concept of, you know, these fanatical Nazis wanting to take over the world. And Gustav was just this kid who wanted to live his a simple life. He wanted to be a railroad locomotive conductor. And so he used to, on a Sunday, he'd pedal his bicycle to the railroad tracks on the Hamburg to Bremen line. And he'd just sit there and watch the trains go by. And then Gustav got called up and they took one look at him because he was a little short guy, barely 5 foot. And they said, you're going right into the tanks.
Wow. Yeah. And you, the way you described the action that Gustav and Clarence fight, you know, faced in the opening chapters, I mean, it seems to shift the balance of the old phrase, you know, war's long periods of boredom punctuated by moments of terror, because these men see a lot of fighting.
They do. And in fact, with this book, I wanted to tell in a different way. In my previous book, A Higher Call, we met the German character when he was a boy and we watched him learn to fly. And we spent two or three chapters getting to know who he was. With this one, we threw you right into the battle. So the first scene of Clarence, he's reloading his tank, shuttling shells into the turret, into the hands of the loader. In Gustav's case, he's getting hit by a bombardment, and they're hiding in their Panther tank while the shells are raining around them within two pages. And so the combat in Spearhead starts, and it doesn't let up. And it's actually a testimonial to the lives these men lived. Some World War II veterans have one story or two to tell their grandkids, but these guys saw the heaviest combat. Gustav, because he was on the losing side of the war, so there was no such thing as R&R for the Germans. Mm. It was you fight until you're wounded or dead. And for Clarence, he found himself leading the First Army into the heart of the Third Reich. And his tank was meant to be always out in front. And we could talk about how he got there. But his wartime career was endless battle. And not just shooting at the enemy tanks. It was leading the charge. It was at the tip of the spear. And that's why he knocked out five enemy tanks in the war. Mm-hmm. That's why he has this film to show of himself fighting in the city of Cologne, and that's how he ended up leading the charge against the Nazi Fort Knox at the end of the war. Wow. A remarkable man.
I certainly want to get to the battle in Cologne. Before we do, though, I want to talk about their actions in the Battle of the Bulge. While they're there, it seems, you know, they were successful, but they suffered heavy losses. Can you tell us a little bit about German tanks and why they were such a tough match for the American tanks?
Certainly. The American tanks, the Sherman was our battle tank all the way through 1944. It had first gone into combat with the British in 42 in the desert of Africa. And it was a fine tank then. It was matched up well against the German Panzer IVs. It was beating them. It could penetrate their armor. And we were happy with it, and they were happy with it. And so we had this quantity over quality mentality. We just kept making them and making them. We could ship them easier because they were a narrow tank. They weren't too heavy. It was a medium tank. Whereas the Germans, they kept upgrading their tanks. So the guns got bigger and the armor got heavier, almost to the point where some of the designs became ridiculous. They had such big armor and such long guns. And so they evolved. We didn't. And eventually got to the point where in the Battle of the Bulge, it really became apparent that you need seven or eight Shermans to take on one Panther, because the Panther was impervious to the Sherman's 75 millimeter gun from any distance. And most of the Shermans there had the 75 millimeter gun. So you could be shooting a Panther from, they did tests in Normandy after they captured their first Panthers. You could shoot it from 10 yards away. You could shoot it from 200, 1,000. You could not penetrate the Panther from up front. We upgraded our gun a little bit to 76 millimeter. They found a few weak spots, but by and large, the rule was if you have a Sherman, you need to get around the side of that Panther or you need to get behind him. And that's an awful thing to ask a man to do when that German tank's standing in front of him. Right. So the Battle of the Bulge taught us we've got a real problem because we lost so many tanks there stopping that breakthrough that we had to borrow tanks from the British to continue the drive into Germany. And they came out of that, and the brass said, we need to do something different if we're to actually finish off the Third Reich.
And they actually did do something different, right?
They did. They shipped over the Pershing T-26E3, and there was a downside. Suddenly he gets the best tank, 90-millimeter gun, better armor, an automatic transmission, which can get them in and out of trouble a lot faster. They could use it actually to back out of problems and back out of dangerous situations. The downside of having the best tank is his commander, after they lost half of the company attacking one field when they were moving toward Cologne, he decided it's time for the Pershing to lead. And not just to lead one attack, to lead every attack until the war is over. So suddenly you go from being a rotation, from having a rotation where, okay, this crew is going to lead today and we get a break, we get a breather, we get to go to the back, to they're in front every time. The downside of being in front was in those days of the war, we're on the offensive. The Germans are on the defensive. So what can they do? They can set up their AT guns and they can emplace them and hide them. They can have the an enemy tank can be watching the hill. They can be watching who's going to be first to come around the bend. They can set their crosshairs right on the spot where they expect us to come. Mm-hmm. And we have to drive into it. And somebody has to go first. And that's where I found Clarence really rose to the occasion and became one of our great heroes. He had an attitude that said, the men inside of this tank are my family. They're my brothers. And the way I can best serve them and serve the men in the tanks behind us is to be the best I can be, to not miss, to shoot straight, to shoot first. And so he summoned this sort of superhuman courage and ability that said, all right, I know I'm driving into the enemy's crosshairs. And somehow I've got to tip the tables on them.
Right. Yeah, and you see that courage coming into play when he's going into Cologne. He's, once again, has to be the lead tank of the task force heading in. And, you know, this battle tends, you know, I see it as the heart of the story. So can you tell us about him in Cologne and how he's finally facing Gustav and the tragic event that follows?
Yes, Clarence, when they reach the gates of the city of Cologne, his tank is the first one to go through, and it's going to lead the way to the Rhine. That was the goal. It would take us 2 days to battle through to the Rhine. The goal was to try to get a bridge over the Rhine, but the Germans would blow that up right when we were on the verge of capturing it. So we would have to cross somewhere else, but it was still the Queen City of Germany. It was known as the Fortress City because Hitler had ordered it fortified. And so it was going to be our largest urban battle of the European war. And now this corporal, 21-year-old Clarence Schmoyer from Coal Country, Pennsylvania, is leading the charge. His commander came across the radio and said, gentlemen, I give you Cologne. Let's knock the hell out of it. And with that, Clarence launched into the city. It became a street fight, block by block, armored infantry moving up on the sides. And always at the tip of the spear, Clarence was leading the way. And on the second day, he was moving toward the spires of the Cologne Cathedral. You could see them in the distance over the rooftops. That was the objective. Once you reached the cathedral, you were at the Rhine. The battle would be won. And as he was battling his way there at a large intersection, sure enough, he caught another German tank in his sight. Before he could get his gun on it, it backed away. It was down the boulevard, and it was a Mark IV, a German Panzer IV. And in it was Gustav Schäfer. Gustav had been sent on a suicide mission into the city, just three tanks from his brigade, and they had been sent to stop an American army. And as they started trading fire, Clarence and Gustav are shooting machine guns at each other, trying to find the other tank, trying to stir up something. There's civilians literally walking across the street. And then what do we see with the army cameraman filming? A little German car, civilian car, drove between these two guys, and both of them shot it to pieces, and the car crashed by the side of the road. They didn't think much of it. There was a battle raging. Clarence knew there was another enemy tank hidden behind a building right in front of him, and Gustav knew Clarence was coming down the boulevard.
Right.
So they had bigger concerns. Clarence finally vanquished Gustav's tank, and he did it in the most creative way. At first, he was trying to shoot through the building with armor-piercing rounds, and then he saw that every time he shot through the building, parts of the building were falling off. Bricks were tumbling down. So he started shooting left to right, and he ended up putting 5 rounds into the building and bringing down a wall on Gustav's tank.
Mm-hmm.
That tank, that disabled the gun, knocked it off its track, and Gustav ended up running away and becoming a POW, and he would live to tell the tale. But that was just a tragic mistake of war. They civilians get caught in the crossfire, and Clarence would later regret that very much. But he knocked out Gustav's tank, and the battle would go on. They still had to fight their way to the cathedral, and one obstacle remained.
Right. And do you want to tell us about that obstacle?
Yes, I certainly will. So right when victory is in sight, Clarence, of course, had been held up at this intersection dueling Gustav. So his unit sent forward 2 Sherman tanks, and behind them, a bunch of Stuart tanks were getting ready. They were going to make the push to the cathedral. And they were about to reach the cathedral square. They were going up this narrow street when suddenly the right tank gets hit. Then the left tank gets hit. And before you know it, 2 Shermans have been knocked out in quick succession by a hidden enemy tank. And with the Army cameraman still filming all of this, we see the American tank commander, Carl Kellner, come out of the turret, roll over to the engine deck. He's missing his right leg. And they would go and rescue him and pull him into a shell hole, and he would bleed to death right there, right at the end of the battle with victory in sight, killed by this fanatical German crew. And what rumbled forward from a tunnel was a Panther tank, known as the pride of the Wehrmacht. It was that tank of the nightmares for many Americans. And so the Panther parked in front of the cathedral, daring anyone to come forward. It was a last stand. The bridge behind them was blown. Most German troops were surrendering, and these guys had come to fight to the end. And then the call went out. Who will deal with this? Who will go forth? And the Pershing crew, one street over from all this, said, we'll do it. And so Clarence made his battle plan. He set the gun as far to the right as he could. He knew they were going to come around the corner, and they'd be looking at this German Panther. What they weren't counting on was that the German Panther, in the time it took the Pershing to drive up the street, turned its gun to face exactly where they would breach the corner. And so when Clarence's driver pulled forward in view of the Panther, he found himself looking down the barrel of this enemy tank, and he floored the gas and he pulled them even further onto the intersection. So now they're completely exposed. Both tanks are broadside to one another, and both tanks have their guns pointing at one another, 75 yards separating them. And meanwhile, an Army cameraman has perched himself in a building, and he's filming the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Clarence shoots. He shoots first. He shoots anywhere he can because he knows he has to disrupt this German gunner. He doesn't have time to aim. And so he just fires into the engine deck of this Panther tank, and it rattles the tank, and it rattles the crew. Smoke starts pouring out, and sure enough, the tank commander comes out and jumps over the side. Sure enough, the driver tumbles over the side. Sure enough, the gunner doesn't fire. But Clarence knows that there's 5 crewmen in that German tank, and it doesn't take just the gunner to shoot at them. If any man reaches the trigger and pulls it, that Pershing tank is going to be destroyed, and his friends are going to be killed. So he shoots it a second time. And he moves his fire to a different spot. And then he shoots it a third time, and he moves his fire to another place. His goal was to make this tank burn. And sure enough, it did. It burst into flames like a volcano. And Clarence's crew quickly backed up their Pershing, caught their breaths. The whole engagement probably took 45 seconds, and it was over. And the Panther tank's smoke billowed high into the sky. The Army cameraman came out of the building after watching all this, and he said to Clarence and the crew, come on up, I want to get your picture. And they came out of the Pershing, and you can see, you have to see their faces. It's on the cover of the book. the photo that was taken from this film.
Right.
It's in the book. You see the 1,000-yard stare. You see men who have literally just stared death in the face 5 minutes earlier. 5 minutes earlier, they had battled that panther. And it still shows. And that film made it into the newsreels. It went around the country, and it made them the most famous tank crew at that time in the war. After that, they drove forward. They reached the Rhine, and they were known as the heroes of Cologne. They had led the way into the city, and through a twist of fate, they had led the way as far as they could go. And they radioed back, Cologne is secure.
Right. I mean, they go through this amazing experience. They get barely have time to breathe after the battle, and then all of a sudden they're called on to lead again. This time they got to head out for the city of Paderborn. And can you tell us why Paderborn was a particularly fearsome objective for tankers?
Well, again, when I had never heard of the battle for Paderborn, and it's because the Spearhead Division was asked to make this long 100-mile drive in 24 hours. And they did it all behind enemy lines to encircle the Ruhr pocket. Paderborn was significant because it was the last doorway by which German communications and troops could flow into the Ruhr, basically keeping the war going, because that's where all the industry was and that's where all the bullets came from and the coal and the metal. And so we had to seal the Ruhr pocket. Paderborn was key to sealing it. We had to take this city. The challenge was the German armor schools were based there. That's where the SS armor school was. That's where the Wehrmacht school was. That's where they tested the new tanks. It was called the Nazi Fort Knox. And in the war's last days on April 1st, it was a scene almost out of a movie. It was like Braveheart. I mean, the American tanks line up on this hill overlooking Paderborn as the sun is rising, and a chaplain goes from tank to tank giving a blessing. And then Clarence leads his task force into this massive armor clash, because waiting for them in the Paderborn rail yard, that was their goal, to take the railroad station. Others were taking the airfield, then they would move into the city itself. Their goal was, again, to just reach the city alive, because the last German tanks of the war were all waiting for them. The instructors from the tank schools had come out, and they'd taken the last tanks, and they perched them in this rail yard, and they said, all right, let's fight the last battle. And so as Clarence is charging across this field with 15 tanks, how many reached the city? How many reached the rail yard? Three. Three out of 15 made it in. And suddenly Clarence finds himself in a running gun battle with two German tanks, and they knock out one of his buddies to his right, and suddenly now there's two American tanks left, and there's a Panther marauding around the rail yard. It's the most veteran crew he's ever faced, and he's going to face his last duel of the war. There's tigers in there. There's panthers. It's a nightmare, and nobody's ever heard of it. They haven't heard of it because the war reporters, I don't know if they were just, I think it's because they were behind enemy lines. There's no photos, but there's documentation that Clarence would knock out another tank that day in the most dramatic duel, even more powerful than his Panther duel. And that's how he ended up with that tally, five enemy tanks destroyed. And the last one would come at the Nazi Fort Knox, and it would come in the most dramatic way possible. I almost don't want to spoil it because it's one of the great tank battles in history.
Yeah, we could certainly leave the details for readers, but I don't think it's giving anything away to say that, you know, after this battle, you know, eventually Clarence does finally make it home and leads a good and happy life, gets married, and then it's decades later when he watches a videotape of that footage that you referenced of the fight in Cologne, and it changes his life. Can you talk about how that happened?
Yes, he had bottled up the war, put it behind him, and then the film is discovered of him as a young man fighting, and he watches it, and it all comes back to him. Now, one of the ways to put the war behind him, according to his buddies, was to talk to somebody about it. Talk to someone about what you saw or what's bothering you or what happened. But Clarence had nobody to talk to. His whole crew had died by then when he saw this film. And the men in the other tanks had died by then. When I found him in 2013, he was one of the last four men of his entire company. So there's nobody to talk to except one person. It dawned on Clarence one day. There was one more man who had seen the same fighting in Cologne that he had, and that was Gustav Schaefer. the German he had fought against at the other end of the boulevard. And so Clarence, through a German journalist, tracked down Gustav Schaefer. They found Gustav to be the last survivor of his unit. And Clarence said, I'm going to try to go meet him. And I asked, can I come along? And I knew I was watching history happen. Two enemies trying to face each other 70 years later. And in 2013, I watched these men approach each other at the Cologne Cathedral. Right at the steps of the cathedral, Gustav the little German, Clarence the tall American, with their hands outstretched, both very nervous, both unsure how this was going to go or if this was a good idea. But sure enough, they shook, they went back to the hotel, they had beers together, and they began telling their war stories about what happened to their crews, the action they had seen. They then went back to the place where they had fought, and they stood on the same grounds. Gustav showed Clarence where his tank was, and Clarence showed Gustav, and they relived their battle. And in essence, talking about it, talking about how they had fought each other, talking about the car that had driven between them, talking about the losses they had seen, they were able to put the war in perspective and put it behind them. And they emerged as friends, exchanging Christmas cards later, letters, Skyping on the computer with one another. They called themselves war buddies, just war buddies from the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a powerful story of how two enemies could find their humanity and how two tankers could recognize that they both shared the same hardships, even though they were in different armies, and that they had a lot more in common than they had between them. And so they became friends until the end, and now Clarence is still going strong. We lost Gustav in 2017, and at his funeral, there was a large bouquet of flowers with words in English that baffled everybody who had come there, and it said, I will never forget you, your brother in arms, Clarence.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable ending for a remarkable story, and I just love the book. Really brought, you know, a tanker's life in World War II. You really get a sense of what was going on, you know, the miserable conditions they went through, and then just the remarkable courage that Clarence portrays throughout the events, leading the charge, as you give example of example. It's quite remarkable. So I really appreciate you, Adam, for sharing with us today, and I want to thank you for being the guest.
It is my honor, Joe, and anything I can do to preserve our Army's heritage, it's a great responsibility for me. And I'm proud to say the book is turning heads, 4 out of 4 stars from USA Today, massive Wall Street Journal review. As we speak, it's sold out at nearly every book chain in the country. It's not because I'm such a good writer. It's because the story of Clarence, the story of Gustav, is just that good.
Right. I do encourage people to check it out. I'm sure the books will be back in stock very soon, probably by the time you're listening. So that book, again, is Spearhead, An American Tank Gunner, His Enemy, and A Collision of Lives in World War II. So thanks again, Adam.
Thank you, Joe.
And to all our listeners, thanks for joining. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Visit AUSA.org for more info. Keep it locked right here for all Army Matters and for next week's episode with Soldier Today. Have a great Army Day.